Hey everybody, I'm Cassie. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. This is huge for me. I'm not used to the podium thing, so I'll try not to freak out too much. I came down from Connecticut. My home group is the Women's One Step at a Time Step Meeting at Stepney Baptist Church in Monroe, and that is a tongue twister. I also am involved in a YPOG group, Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous. It is Young and the Restless in Trumbull, Connecticut. I'm just asking God to guide me. I'm very nervous. I'm always nervous when I speak. My sponsee came with me, so we traveled down, and luckily we didn't hit any traffic, so no character defects coming out there as far as road rage. And I'm really blessed to be sober, and I get really emotional when I speak, because I always had ideas and thoughts about what I wanted in my life, and it was like grandiose expectations or grandiose hopes, and what I've gotten through AA has been far beyond what I could have anticipated for myself, and the hell I went through to get here was so worth it, now that I see that, and the pain that I've gone through, and just my experience, you know. People told me that, you know, don't quit before the miracle happens, and I'm just glad I didn't. So, my experience, strength, and hope. I'm 29 years old. I was born in Stratford, Connecticut. I still reside in Stratford, Connecticut. I've tried to move out of Stratford, Connecticut, and I still am there, but that's a good thing. I am the oldest of two kids in a non-alcoholic household. My father is a rageaholic, I like to call him. We definitely have all the defects, but there's never really been any drinking until I quit, naturally. My mom started engaging in a lot of wine tasting, but not alcoholic. And I don't know how that happened, that I had this disease, but looking back and talking with my mom, talking with my family, it's definitely in my family. It just not was inherited generation to generation as far as parent to child. My great-grandfather was a fall-down alcoholic. He had 8 kids, and they had to support the family back in the Great Depression because he was such a fall-down alcoholic that was what my grandfather knew, and that's, you know, he raised my mom in this sheltered lifestyle. My cousins were all alcoholic like that. And I think that he didn't drink out of fear, and so she didn't drink out of fear. And, you know, but I grew up with a lot of fear. I always remember, I can remember back to being 3 years old and being in preschool, and it's so weird, it's like, who thinks about that stuff but alcoholics? And I remember being 3 years old in preschool and playing with kids, and I had this one best friend, and you know, somebody else would be playing with her, I'd be so jealous, and I would feel like the outsider, and you know, that was the start of how I felt pretty much my whole life until I came into these rooms. I was always afraid of how I looked. I was afraid of how I felt. I was afraid of what people thought about me. And I've lived most of my life that way. I always felt undeserving. Like, if anything good happened to me or somebody said something good to me that, you know, I didn't deserve it, I always felt less than. But at the same time, I was very self-centered, and it was all about me. And I never understood how those two can work together, how you can be self-centered, but you can think so little of yourself at the same time. And I have a younger brother, and we never got along growing up, and we still struggle to get along, and that's tough for me. But I grew up in a household without drinking, lots of character defects. My parents had a lot of fighting when we were growing up. We were in a middle-class family, and there used to be physical altercations. occasions between them. They entered therapy when I was 10 years old. And it kind of like started this wavelength where, you know, I had my issues with acting out. My brother had his issues with acting out. And there was always some sort of discipline problem, it seemed, in the household. I don't know if anybody can identify with that. So we had a lot of issues growing up. And they had entered therapy. And at that point, I was about 10 years old. And at 10, you know, I was starting to get into boys, starting to be in that prepubescent phase where you're starting to feel like really ugly in your skin, starting to get really into materialistic things, starting to have a lot of emotions. And, you know, I didn't know where I fit in. And I always thought that, you know, like, that life was happening around me and I wasn't a part of it. And I don't know where that came from. I feel like it was just intrinsic. It was inside me, and nobody really installed it. It just kind of developed on its own. And I was always scared. I always felt like I needed something external. And I think it started when I was younger as far as, like, money things. Like, I had to have nice clothes. I had to have the best friends, you know, being on the right side of the fence with all the cool girls at lunchtime, sitting at that table. And I never felt part of, even though, you know, I mean, look, on the outside, like, I was part of. I never felt part of. And so I think, like, when I was 12, I remember a lot of changes happening. And I'd entered junior high school. My brother was having a lot of behavioral issues. I'd entered junior high school, and I started to go through a lot of changes. And I became very depressed. I was sitting in rooms just with the lights out, the curtains drawn, just totally covered in blackness. And my mom knew something was wrong, took me to the doctor, and he diagnosed me with depression. And, you know, I thought that was kind of like the end of the world. I was going through all these changes, all these peer things that you go through in junior high school, you know, just adolescent changes. And, you know, I kind of felt like really distinguished as being apart from people. I mean, which teenager goes to school and gets diagnosed with depression? So, you know, nowadays there's all these different diagnoses out there, but I just didn't feel good. And I remember that in that period of time, that was when I had my first drink of alcohol. I was alone in my room one night, and I had had friends over a couple days before, and they were kind of like, you know, moving along the spectrum, so to speak, a little quicker than I was. Like, they're like, oh, your mom has booze in her cabinet, let's go out there. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get in trouble. But, you know, they kind of showed me what to do. And so one night I went into that cabinet, pulled out the bottle of Absolut, opened up like an empty 1 liter seltzer bottle, poured the Absolut in there, and then filled the Absolut with water because my parents didn't drink, so they wouldn't know. And I started to drink that until I fell asleep, and I don't remember much. I just kind of passed out, so I can't really say, like, that was my first drink, but it wasn't like my real first drunk. Like, it wasn't like that glorious drunk that I hear a lot of people talk about, because I just kind of passed out. I didn't feel my feelings, and that was the effect I was going for, but, you know, I just passed out. So that spring, I ended up having a lot of, like, acting out. I went to this doctor. This doctor was, like, always in the picture. It was the psychiatrist, and he's like, you know, let me try you on this medication. He tried me on this medication. I totally go haywire, and it just turned out that I was diagnosed as being bipolar. And for me, that was very hard. That was very hard because I was 13 years old, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of, like, child psychology. This was early 90s, and I didn't know many people going to psychiatrists. And my crowd, you know, they were playing softball, and they were going to dances, and they were participating in activities, and I was going to the psych ward. And all those feelings of feeling left out were validated. And from that point on, like, I just shut out everything I knew as far as people existing, as far as being helpful. I had ideas of God when I was younger. And, I believed in Mickey Mouse till I was 10, so there was no problem believing in God. But, I kind of felt like he'd abandoned me. And I think from that point on, I really lost a lot of myself. So I answer. During that time, I was on a lot of medication, and I should mention that just because pills have to do with a lot of my story, and that's where it began. And I had kind of gathered the thought that, you know, all feelings that I had with the bipolar, if I felt manic, if I felt depressed, you treated it with a pill. And that was the solution. And that's what I was conditioned to learn, is that all this emotional instability that I had, you medicated it. And that was what I was taught, and that was what seemed okay. And I started to really fiddle with that, because when I got into high school, I started learning about alcohol and drugs, and, you know, everything else seemed to cease to be a dream. I had all these dreams. Ever since I was 7, I wanted to work in medicine. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a surgeon. I used to take out books on, like, gallbladder surgery and, you know, chemistry and get all into it. And that was fascinating for me. You know, when you're a kid, you're innocent and you have all these dreams. And I was this teenager and I was lost, and all these dreams were so far away from me because I had this diagnosis that I felt that I was never going to be normal, and I was never going to have a normal life, because that's what it meant to me, was that I was always going to need something foreign to make me feel normal. And so I think, like, the hopelessness that I came into AA with began then also. And When I was a freshman in high school, I remember what I refer to as my first drink, what was really my first drug. And it was, I went out with a girlfriend of mine. We always got into trouble. We'd steal street signs. We'd smoke cigarettes in the laboratory. We'd do anything that we could do just because it was deviant. And at that time, the Aerosmith song that says, "Partner in Crime," she was my partner in crime, so we always joke about that, because we were always getting in trouble, and her mom hated me, and my mom hated her, so it was like a perfect couple. And we went out one night, and we just, you know, her sisters were older, so they had all these connections, they got us beer, and I drank like 4 beers, and I was totally wasted. And I felt great, because all that shelled up feelings of, like, I'm not good enough, and, you know, I can't face you head on and, like, have a conversation with you eye to eye, that wasn't there. Alcohol took that away from me. And I felt, like, confident. I felt like a part of. I felt that I could look you in the eye and not be afraid. And all that fear was gone. And I was good enough. And I was pretty enough. And I was smart enough. And that was from booze. And from that moment on, I thought I felt I found my solution to everything that was my problem. Next day, I had the worst hangover of my life. I called every family member I knew. I told them to come to my bedside because I was dying. My little aunt, who's my godmother, she's like a little over 4'10", just came over. She's like, "Oh, I made you cookies." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm dying." You know, all dramatic. And my parents didn't know what was going on. But I didn't remember much from that night. I just remember, you know, being really drunk, feeling really good, probably making an ass out of myself, and coming to the next day feeling really sick, but being like, "No, I'm not going to do that again because I'm sick." But then a couple days later feeling like, you know, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad. And I don't recall having my alcoholism take off quickly from that point on. I know that I tampered with other substances that I won't get too involved in, but, you know, we thought we were hippies in high school, and this was the early 90s, and so we'd wear, like, tie-dyed shirts, and some girls had dreads, and some girl had pink hair, and, you know, we'd just, like, go out after school, and every single day there was some sort of substance, whether it be booze, whether it be hallucinogens or pot, it didn't matter, you know, as long as it was something to get me out of this feeling of discontent. And it was there, and that was like my saving grace. That was what was the solution for my internal struggle back then. And all those grandiose ideas that I had about being a doctor, you know, they just kind of, they were there. It's like, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll apply myself tomorrow. And I always got these reports from teachers to my parents that, you know, she's so smart, she just needs to apply herself. And, you know, it was like, apply myself. You know, I've been unfortunate. You diagnosed me as bipolar, told me I'm never going to have a normal life, that I'm always going to need a substance to rule it. You know, I thought that, like, that was where, like, victimhood was a lot in my fourth step, like victimization. And I think then that was kind of like how it manifested, was that I had this sense of entitlement that the world owed me because I was sick. And so at the, you know, during that time, I was really just not well. I was emotionally unstable. I was plagued with depression and mania and hospitalizations back and forth and, you know, just therapy around the clock. My doctor didn't know what to do to me or do with me. And I think about in step two in the book where it talks about Carl Jung and how he tells the fellow, you know, I can't help you. And I remember my doctor just sitting there, like, I would sit in my sessions, and I'd be, like, sitting there for an hour, and I'd just be, like, trying to kill him with my eyes and my looks. Looks could kill. And I was just so stubborn, and he's like, you know, you're an alcoholic, and there's nothing I can do for you. And it was like, this guy was making $140 an hour, and he's telling me he can't do anything for me. I didn't care. I didn't want to be there anyways. I was just going to please my parents. And, you know, I kind of struggled back and forth. I'd had bouts of not using, and then bouts of taking my medication, bouts of not taking my medication, and bouts of using. So at some point, I was always trying to control my feelings with something. And I remember the end of my freshman year, my mom had a really bad episode with depression, and she was making arrangements to go down to MLZ Clinic, I think like in Tennessee or something, I don't know where it is, but I remember being in my kitchen, I was probably about 15, and I was just like holding on to her leg, because I was so scared, and I was like, Mom, don't go, you know, why are you doing this? She's like, I look at all these other kids, and I look at you, and I see how unhappy you are. And I felt like I caused this. Like, she's going there because of me, because of something I did. And that feeling of, like, uselessness became even heavier. And it came to the point where, you know, I'm like, I don't benefit anybody. I don't see my purpose. And I just continued down a path of self-destruction even further. My drug use became daily. Alcohol was mostly on the weekend. It was hard to get. It was a lot easier to get drugs in high school than it was to get booze. And plenty of times I almost got caught in class passing. So, you know, I'm very fortunate because I had a lot of yes, and a lot of oopses, and a lot of almosts, and, you know, I really, somebody was looking out for me, but, high school was very hard for me. My sophomore year was probably the worst out of all of my years. every day I was plagued by, like, some form of needing to medicate. And I was on a slew of medications. By that time, I had really dampened pills. I was on, I was taking amphetamines for ADD because I just didn't want to learn. And what I was doing was I was going in the bathroom and I was abusing them and I was snorting them. And that became like one of the first addiction that was really real and scary, and I needed it and I would do anything possible to get it. And I always resort back to that. I had lost about 20 pounds. I was leaving class every 20 minutes to go get high. I was doing it in the bathroom. I wasn't sleeping. I was using sedatives to go to sleep or drinking a bunch to go to sleep. And my life was just pretty much ruled by drugs at that point. That summer, I had started up using a lot of cocaine, and I went into what my mom thought was like a psychotic binge because I was really just frantic and I was angry and I was having rages and I threw up against a wall and there was just a lot of acting out. And so they had, because I was only 16, they were able to commit me against my own will. And I spent that whole weekend, which was my boyfriend at the time's prom weekend, in the hospital, and I wasn't able to go to his prom, which now I see was probably a saving grace. But with what I had in mind about prom, I could have died that weekend. And at that point, like, I kind of was under lock and key. My junior year, I wasn't allowed to go back to my high school for the first semester. I had to go to Hallbrook School, which is in Westport. It's a psych hospital. And they have a school there. So I had to be educated there for about 6 months. Which for those 6 months, I mean, I pretty much fared pretty well. I ended up coming back to school my junior year. I was on honors for the first half of the semester, the second semester. And it's amazing, like, when you're off of drugs and alcohol, what you're capable of doing, you're living the right way. And I didn't see any correlation. You know, I just kind of thought I hit a bad patch and that, you know, now seeing I was removed from the situation, I was better. And I came back. I was doing well. I had good grades. I was going out occasionally, like on the weekends, with my boyfriend at keg parties, and I would get drunk then. And, you know, it didn't go back to a daily use. I kind of laid off the drugs for a while. And I was doing well. And so towards the end of that year, I kind of figured, you know, hey, I got it under control. And I started using pills again. And then my life spun out of control again. And my senior year was really hard. I got by through high school just because they felt bad for me. I had a lot of involvement with the school psychologists, school social worker. They pretty much manipulated the situation so I could get through. There's no reason I should have graduated high school. And the weird thing is that I still have these dreams that I'm there, because I have these dreams that, you know, I didn't do the work. I didn't do the work. They just, like, pitied me and got me out of there. Probably just to, you know, wipe their hands clean. But, you know, that was another saving grace. And in that period that I was dry, before I went to Hallbrook, I'd been exposed to NA. And I definitely did not belong in any 12-step program. I'd gone to a couple AA meetings, and I was not one of you guys, for sure. And I just kind of went to make my mom happy. And, you know, I would go in the bathroom and I would do drugs. And I didn't care. It was just, you know, it was all about me and how I felt. And I was going to do what I wanted to do. And I didn't care about anybody else or endangering anybody's welfare. And now I see it, I'm like, what the heck? Who was doing what in a meeting? And I'm like, whoa, you know, hello, be humble here. And, you know, I'm just an alcoholic, basically. So, you know, that lasted just very little while. I'd gotten an NA book, which I don't still have, and I used to be like, I don't need this. So I'd start, you know, doing drugs or using it as a placemat for my drink, whatever. Just kind of like, I don't need this. This is not for me. I got it under control. Thank you very much. So, I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth. I had no plans for college. I still, towards the end, was under the delusion that I was going to end up really successful. I don't know how I planned on doing it or how it was going to happen, because I barely made it through my SATs. For some reason, I've always been good at math and science, and I did good in math, but English, everything else, you know, I went in with a hangover. I don't know if anybody ever did that with SATs. But I went in with a hangover, and I just kind of, you know, did it to get it done. And I did a lot of stuff like that just to, like, get it done and over with. I didn't put any effort into it. I didn't really care. And now I see the importance of all those mistakes and those choices I made. But I also, the end of senior year, I missed a lot of school, and like I said, I barely made it through. That summer, throughout this time, I'm still going to the psychiatrist. I'm still, like, intermittently taking this medication that they put me on. I mean, I'd been on everything from Depakote to lithium and been sick to my stomach and you name it, I was on it. And that summer, I had gotten into a lot of trouble. I'd been fired from several jobs. I had gotten into one car accident under the influence of Demerol. I don't remember. I ended up in the hospital. They shot me up with something that knocked me right out. And then a couple days later, I got into another car accident. And I had a lot of drugs on me. I had an open beer in my lap. And the cop let me go. And I don't know if that was a good thing, but that day I ended up, my parents had had enough. I'd been living with them the whole time. They put up with all of these things. I think that they just felt bad, and they hoped that, you know, they could correct this and do the right thing. And as long as they did the right thing, I was going to be okay. And, you know, they just, without them, I'd be dead. And I totally see that. And they were like a liability to me, which I was a liability to them, totally. But, you know, they really saved my ass so many times. And I'm really grateful for that. And I have a good relationship with them today because of it. But that day, they called, like, an intervention. I had the intervention. And they said, you know, your drinking and drug use has gotten out of control. I was drinking daily. I was drugging daily. And I always, if I wasn't under the influence, I was taking a lot of sleeping medication just to sleep through my feelings. And they said, the option that we have to offer you is that if you go to rehab and deal with this, we will take you back into our house. But if you don't do this, you can't live with us. You need to find somewhere else to go. And that was the choice that I had, and I chose to leave. Because I was not ready to admit that I had a problem. For me, it was still the solution. And I hated myself so much. I tried to kill myself many times by that point. And from at that point on, it was just, all I could see was not death, just numbing. Like, I just needed to keep numbing. And I had moved out that day. And my mom begged me several times. She's like, please just take this option. Take this option. And I was like, no, I don't have a problem. So I was just kind of, they wiped their hands clean of me. I had school tuition that was paid for. I had a car. I had a place to stay. They took the car. They canceled my school semester, all my classes. My doctor refused to see me, so I had no health insurance, no medical care, and nowhere to stay. I had a friend, Jessica, who, thank God, today is sober as well. Her parents lived in Florida about 10 months out of the year, and when you have a teenage daughter at home, it's not a good idea. We had a lot of stuff going on at her house. Oh my goodness. So that was where I went. And for me, it was like, okay, you know, because I spent a lot of time in that house. It was like going home. But my mom, in the meantime, had told all my cousins, all my grandparents, all my aunts and uncles, you know, if you see her, don't give her anything. Nothing. And I had no one. I just had my friend, and I had the people who I referred to as friends. Along this period of time, I had started out with all these friends when I was in elementary school, and they all ended up being like lawyers, and you know, some of them went to Yale, some of them went to Cornell. I went to community college at some point, but you know, they all had like this great future ahead of them, and I ended up with people that, you know, I was going out to Bridgeport to buy crack with at 4 a.m. You know, this is where my friends went, because that's what I saw. And those people wanted nothing to do with me, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't looking for a prosperous life. I was looking for the next false feeling to drown out all these bad feelings that I had about myself. And so I lived with Jessica for about 4 months. Every single night there was a party at that house. Every single night there was a different drug to try. You had one room, one thing going on, one room, another thing going on. And there was no adults. We were 18 and we were loving it. I mean, this was every 18-year-old's dream. And we had tons of people coming over, and when you're a girl, you really don't have to do much to get free drugs. They just kind of give it to you. Free drinks around the clock. And this was how I lived. I found a job with her, and it was just something minimal. It just covered my habit. My parents thought I was doing okay. They're like, oh, you know, we'll give you a couple bucks here and there. And then that January, my grandmother was like, oh, we're going to Florida for 4 months. How would you like to look after our house? I was like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. So for 4 months, I lived alone in their house, and that was not much different. There were keg stands, there were footprints on the ceiling, literally, that we had to get off. There was broken glass everywhere. I pulled a knife on someone. The cops were called. It was just all this chaos in my life, and this was my life. This was, you know, I couldn't see anything else. I couldn't see all this possibility, that dream of working in medicine, having a husband, having children. All those things that I wanted, they weren't happening, because I had shut out God and I had lost all hope, and all I knew was what I controlled. And at that point, my drinking and driving was just out of control. I had no choices anymore. I used to kind of regulate. I'd take one pill to get high, one pill to get low, and one drug, one drink, whatever. It owned me. And so, you know, my life was out of control for a little while, but my parents had felt bad, and I guess they figured, you know, I'd learned my lesson, brought me back into the house, and for some odd reason, I don't know what it was, I kind of settled down with the drugs, and I just picked up with the alcohol. I guess I figured that that would be better transition. You know, drugs were more my problem. I tried several solutions of switching beers, switching alcohols. You know, I totally got rid of blackberry brandy. That was absolutely out of the question. Jack Daniels was more, worked better for some reason. Yukon Jack. So I was living with them again, and I started to go to school. I guess I, in a way, like, kind of got scared straight, went to school. Worked full-time, and for a couple years, like, I seemed like I was getting it together, and I thought what I was having was functional life. Like, and I was becoming a functional alcoholic, how I see it now and how it's been taught to me, is that I was drinking on the weekends, but every weekday I was obsessing about it, that I was going to work, and I was showing up, I was doing what I had to do, and just kind of faking it. And I hear a lot in here, you fake it till you make it. Well, I did that plenty out here, so when I came into AA, that really was no different. And I should have been able to do it without a problem. So, kind of jumping along, I came into AA in 2001. I turned 21 December 27, 2000. My 21st birthday was the first time I got kicked out of a bar. And I remember during that time frame saying, watch, by the end of the year I'll be in AA. And I was. And I was here because I wanted to be here. And that was the worst year of my drinking ever. And I'm so grateful for it because it's shown me the truth. And I remember sitting in our town bar, which was the dump, but that was my bar, and having a conversation with my friend. And for some reason, we were talking about God. And I had said to her, I said, there is no God. And that was the first time I said that, and I believed it. And that was, you know, I always, like, neglect him and not look up to him and not acknowledge him because I felt that I hadn't received anything. But that was the first time that I believed it. And that was really scary. But, you know, I'm glad that I had that bottom too, because it brought me to where I am. And so I had had a pretty rough summer in 2001. I had a lot of deaths going on. I had some health problems. And I remember, I don't know why, like I remember to this day, it was actually 8 years ago today, August 4th, 2001. I had a lot of drama that day. A lot of traumatic things happened, and it was very significant to me. And I hit my knees that day like I never meant it before. I hit my knees and I asked God, I said, whatever your will is for me, I believe, just help me, because I don't want any more foxhole prayers. Don't get me out of this so I don't get arrested, or I don't get in trouble with so-and-so, or my boyfriend doesn't get mad at me. I need help. Like, I'm tired of this hell. And I meant that. And it's so weird that, you know, like, I'm here today, August 4th, and it's 8 years later. And I thought that was pretty cool when Chris had asked me. And a month and a half later, I came to AA. That whole month after I said that prayer, it was pretty much a blur, drinking every day, morning and night. And I wasn't a morning drinker. I didn't drink alone most of the time. I mean, there were those occasions that, you know, you have to drink alone because you can't get out of the house or whatever. But I was drinking alone, I was drinking a lot, and I was eating Ativan in the meantime. And how I didn't die so many times is just beyond me, and now I can't fail to acknowledge that there's a purpose of why I'm still alive, and I have to be grateful for that. So, September 21st, 2001, I woke up in the morning, and that day is very significant for me because that day I decided I was going to die and I was going to kill myself. And I got in my car, I drove down River Road in Shelton, Connecticut, and I drove along the Susquehanna River, and I was about to pull my car off the road, and something just, like, in my heart said, don't do this. And I think that was my higher power. And I had seen a doctor at that point. I was, during this whole time, taking my medication, doing what I was supposed to, but I was drinking, so I mean, I didn't think that was applicable because I wasn't using drugs. And I called, I said, you know, I need help because I just want to die. Like, I don't see any way out. And so he said, hey, go to St. Vincent's Hospital. I went there. I had called, I still didn't really know what was going on. I was seeing this therapist, and it was actually my parents' therapist when I was 10 that they started seeing. And so I was seeing her, and she said, Cassie, maybe you want to do something about your drinking. I'm like, what? Like, I'm talking about my boyfriend, I'm talking about my job, I'm talking about my finances. She's like, maybe you want to do something about your drinking. Before that, during that period, like, preceding my suicide attempt, she had said to me, why don't you try to limit it at 6? Now I see the error in that, because most people are like, why don't you try 1 or 2? How many people get 6? So I wasn't able to do that anyway. So I ended up going to the ER, and with what she had in mind, I took the first step, and I knew I was powerless over alcohol. That was without a doubt. I knew my life was unmanageable, definitely. But I didn't understand exactly what powerlessness entailed as it played out. I didn't understand the allergy. I ended up going into a rehab for the weekend. I was terrified of staying home, and given like my suicide threat, they didn't feel that I was safe enough to go home anyways, which was fine. I didn't want to be home. And so I went in there, and you know, it was like you're on lockdown, there's people hallucinating because they're schizophrenia. There's people, that one girl had like burned her whole leg with sulfuric acid. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm here for drinking. I thought I was different, I don't know why, because I wasn't any different than anybody else there. But I was telling one of the nurses, I was like, you know, I feel like I'm an alcoholic. I really, everything that's happened to me has been a result of alcohol or drugs. And so she's like, you know, we have a big book in the other room. And I pulled it out, and I was like, oh my gosh, you know, this is weird. And so I started looking at it. I'm like, good alcoholic. I went to chapter one. I totally skipped through all the forewords, all the doctor's opinions. And I started reading chapter one. I'm like, oh my God, this guy was a low-bottom drunk, Bill story. And I'm like, I don't identify with that. But it's like, you know, we're talking about the 1920s, and I'm not making bathtub gin. So, you know, I just said I couldn't differentiate the true from the false, I guess. So, but I read on and I identified, and I feel like, you know, that I'm so grateful that that book was there. And now I'm like, you know, I like to have big books available to people because of that. Because, you know, I'm so passionate about AA. If that wasn't there for me, I might not be standing here. So, I'd gone in, I read. My mom had called me, and, you know, we were trying to, like, patch up our relationship. I was living home. And she said to me, she said, you know, why don't you try going to AA meetings? I'm like, I don't need AA. I can, you know, I got this. And it was like, I hung up the phone, and I just got this overwhelming feeling. And it was like total God rush, because I just felt this feeling like, I can't do this alone. These people, they know how to do this. They're sober. I don't know anything. And, you know, that experience of being exposed to NA and a little bit of AA, that was what, you know, installed that in me. And I'm glad. And, you know, if I see people come and they don't stay, maybe they'll come back. Because I did. And so, you know, I came in. And I didn't get a sponsor right away. I stayed sober for like a month, and I was white knuckling it, and I was still hanging out with all my old friends, and they were like smoking crack and doing pills and everything else around me. I didn't change people, places, and things. I didn't take suggestions. I just kind of did what I thought it was supposed to offer me, and somebody said, get a sponsor. Well, I kind of sponsor hopped for a little bit. I met this woman who graduated high school with my mom, and she was like, she lived right around the corner from me. She took me to meetings, and she brought me to Trumbull AA, which is still my home group today. And I remember being a month sober, walking in that meeting, and I was the youngest person, 21 years old. I was the youngest person. I go to conventions now, and there's people there that are 12 years old. And then there's people that are my age, and they've got like 17 years. I'm like, where the hell was I, you know? But, you know, for a long time, I was the youngest person in my home group, and that's okay with me. Because now I see all these girls, and they're coming in, and I'm like, stay, you know? Because sobriety's been so awesome to me. And so I had gotten a sponsor, and she kind of, you know, she helped me get introduced to the fellowship. I got a couple commitments. I had started working, like, a workbook, and we had gotten up to 1, 2, and 3. By this point, I knew God existed, because me coming into these rooms, that feeling after I humped my mom, that was not me. Me not killing myself, that was not me. I knew that that was him, and I believed, and I knew that I needed that belief or else I was going to die. And I knew I was going to die because I should have been dead so many times. You don't mix pills and drink. I'm a nurse now. I know that. And so I'd come in, and we had gotten through 1, 2, and 3. I got to step 4, and it was like out of this workbook, and I was just so confused, and I was getting so restless, and just like all those feelings that I drank over and I drugged over, I was starting to get those in sobriety, and I'm like, oh, you know, why am I doing this again? And I had shared about it in a meeting, and it wasn't this woman's fault. She just didn't know, like, the way that I've been taught so far to go through the steps at this point. But this woman, Deirdre, she had approached me, and she said, you know, if you need to go through the steps, I'm available. Call me tonight. We'll meet tomorrow. And I had already written out some things, and I met with her the next day, and she started me on step 4. And that was exactly where I needed to be. This woman worked me to the bone. I was so angry. I was yelling. So many times I'd sit in her house, and she'd be like, you know, I'm about to give you $5 to go drink if you don't get off the pity pot. And that was what I needed. That was what I needed, because all those times in the psychiatrist's office, I'm sitting there and I'm like, it looks could kill. I was like that, but I was sober. And this woman, she saw right through me, and that was exactly what I needed. And, you know, some people are like, that's too harsh. And I try not to be that way as a sponsor. That was her style. But that was what I needed, because I was definitely not getting anywhere on, you know, patting me on the back. Okay, it's okay. Because I was full of self-pity. I was full of victimization. She used to go like this, like a little V to the forehead. That fourth step was huge for me. And the way she took me through it, the way it's laid out in the book, and I know, like, Chris is huge. I hear him so many times just, like, giving speeches, because when I had come in and I had started on that fourth step, they were just doing big book studies in my area. They had just started that whole epidemic, I like to call it, because now it's everywhere. It's like every day of the week, somebody's got a big book study at their house or at the church or something's going on. And it's awesome, and I'm so glad that I'm a part of that, because I know myself, and I know what my defects are, and I'm not afraid anymore to face it. But, you know, I can't say that I made a searching and fearless moral inventory, because I was full of fear. But I did it because I didn't want to die. And there were so many things that I didn't want to put in there. And things that, you know, I hear people talk about, that one thing that you're not going to tell. And I had that one thing. And I didn't write it down, but I told it, because I was too afraid that I was going to drink again. And for me, it wasn't worth the risk. I would rather she look at me like I had 4 eyes than me go take the chance of drinking, because I was so afraid. I was starting to get my life together. I mean, I didn't really have much. I was going to school, but that was okay, because I wasn't feeling tortured, and I wasn't ruled by alcohol at that point. So she had brought me through the steps up to step 9, and she told me that I had to go out and I had to make my hardest amends first. And that was to this girl that I had started to get into a physical altercation with. I had gotten into a physical altercation with at a bar over my ex-boyfriend, and it was pretty embarrassing. So I had called her up and I said, hi, it's Cassie. I need to make an amends to you. Can we make an appointment to meet? And she's like, I don't really have time. And I was like, okay, well, here's my number. I did everything I was taught to do, and she never called me back, but I called her again and I tried to make that effort. And, you know, today she sees me and I can hold my head high. And she knows that I was willing to make that attempt and that, you know, I'm trying to be a better person. And I'm okay with her. I can see her. I can go where she is. And it's not like, oh my gosh, I need to cower down or I need to be like, I'm better than you. I can just be eye to eye. And that's what, you know, one of the gifts the 9th step has brought me. I didn't have too many financial amends to make because I didn't have any money. I guess, like, one of the biggest ones is to my parents. I stole a lot from them, but over time I've made a lot of restitution. But during my ninth step, my sponsor got really sick with bipolar illness, which I was not too, which I was pretty familiar with. She got sick and she couldn't sponsor me anymore. And so I had gone back to the woman who was sponsoring me prior to that, and I learned to, you know, be a friend for the first time, which was really important to me. I was about a year sober and struggling, but showing up, doing what I had to do. You know, I kept working the steps, getting all this baggage out of the way. And for a couple years, you know, I kept going to big book studies. I kept trying to reach out. I wasn't really sponsoring people. Nobody wanted a little 21, 22-year-old to sponsor them because I was the youngest one in my home group. And whatever, it is what it is, but that's okay. But, you know, I had this pretty amazing life, and things were starting to look up. In 2005, it was like June, and I got into a family fight with my cousins, and I think that kind of started something. I caught a resentment in AA, and from that point, I started to get a lot of resentments. I started to hang out around, and we call it in Trumbull, denial aisle. And I started to sit in denial aisle. I would gossip during meetings. I wouldn't listen. I would say what I wanted to do. I would hang out with people that weren't the winners. And I was used to hanging out with the winners because that's what I wanted. But I didn't fiend for that anymore. And guess what? I picked up pills, and it got far worse than I thought it was. I had 4 years, and I relapsed. And relapsing with time is very humbling because, you know, you think you're kind of like out of the woods and kind of like have a lot of pride with having time. And, you know, this time I've learned what it's really about. It's about quality of sobriety. But I ended up picking up pills. I thought I got that alcoholic insanity where I'm like, you know, I can do this. I have pain. I'm allowed to take them. It's okay. And I ended up taking them. I went into a 3-month binge and ended up 4 days of detoxing on my own. And I'd never gone through physical detox. And let me tell you, that hurt. And I'm just glad that I'm here because I'm really lucky. But the first thing I did was I came back here and I jumped in both feet. I had that obsession every single day for 3 months straight. It did not go away. That first time, you know, I was kind of okay. Like, I would have a reprieve here and there, and I would be all right. But, you know, I ended up the second time around, it was there every single day, every single minute. I'm like, do I drink? Do I not drink? Do I drink? Do I not drink? And it was just like that battle in my head. And for some reason, God kept me here. And I remember the day I had 6 months, I was at my women's meeting, which is my home group. And they're like, oh, tonight we have coins. I'm like, oh my God, I have 6 months today. It wasn't about time anymore. It was about how I felt. And this time I came in and I really jumped in. And, you know, I try to get at it every single day. I was in nursing school when I relapsed in that first semester. I kind of, you know, didn't do very well, but I made it through. I ended up graduating from Quinnipiac University, which is a very good university, and with a bachelor's in nursing, and I'm working in medicine. I'm fulfilling that dream, and that's because I'm sober. Today, you know, I get very involved in AA. I get very involved with young people that I see, you know, try to help them, to save them from this destruction. I mean, and I'm lucky because I got here when I got here, and but I still felt all those things that every alcoholic feels. I mean, every time I picked up, something happened in my body where I couldn't stop. And that is why I'm an alcoholic, and I know that. I know that inside and out, and I remember that every single day. I can be okay, and I can do this. But, you know, I have to surrender every day. I have a good relationship with my higher power. I trust him with everything. And I recently, I have 3 bad discs in my back. I'm surprised I've lasted so long standing up here. I can't believe I've talked for so long. I guess because I'm nervous. But I trust him with the pain. I know I'll be okay. And I know I don't need to depend on medication. And I'm scared shitless, to be perfectly honest, because I see people with back pain. And, you know, I don't want to relapse, but I'm going to do everything I can. I mean, drive down from Connecticut, do what I got to do, because I don't want this to get me. This disease is real. It wants me dead. I know it wants me dead because I had 4 years and I went back out. And, you know, it's not about time. It's just, I love my life enough. I have good relationships. I have a wonderful relationship with my family who didn't want anything to do with me. I have wonderful friends. And, you know, I just do what I'm supposed to do. I try to live the right way, best possible, and I fail. I make mistakes, but I allow myself to be human. And, you know, I just try to show up best I can. So thank you.